Let's learn a little bit. Okay, Parshas Tazria. So I have a little shorter session because of the conflict, but let's get started. Parshas Tazria on page 608 in your Chumashim. So the first series of verses, which we are not going to be discussing, but just to give us context, begins with the laws of childbirth and purification, that after a woman has a baby, a boy or a girl, different days, depending on which gender she gives birth to, that she becomes tameya, she becomes ritually impure, and then the Torah gives her purification process, again, different for boys or for girls, discussed it in past years, and we are beginning not with that section, but beginning with chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel. The Torah begins the laws of Tzara'as. So because this year we have two separate, we always have two separate parshas, we don't always read them in the same week. A long series. This whole parsha this week is going to discuss the laws of how a person gets tzaras. And then next week we'll discuss primarily how you get out of having tzaras. Tzaras, again, is a spiritual malady. It can come in one of three forms, as the Torah discusses. It can happen first on the walls of one's house. The walls can become discolored, a green, a red, various colors. A Jew shows it to the Kohen, he shows it to the priest, he says, what's going on with this? And depending on what he sees, he will either quarantine the home, he'll determine it to be tzaras. It can happen on a person's clothing, where the clothing becomes discolored, or it can happen on a person's skin, which is what we'll discuss this afternoon. A person can find a discolored patch on his skin, a white or a red, a yellow. The Torah describes with a hair, without a hair, exactly what the coloration looks like, all sorts of details, which we're not going to get to all of those details. You could read the Parsha on your own and work it through, and there's an entire process depending on the type of splotch that the Kohen sees, where the person who has it is quarantined and then determined to be Tameh. If they're Tameh, they are sent out of the camp. They have to live in isolation for a week until it heals, and then they're brought back, and then there's a whole purification process. The basics of this is a spiritual punishment, so to speak. It's a spiritual message, really, that a person has something to work on. The sages very famously describe Lashon Hara as one of the primary reasons why a person can get tzaras if a person uses their speech inappropriately. One of the primary reasons why they would be struck with tzaras. There are other reasons as well, which is evidenced by the fact that even a baby can have tzaras. The Gemara talks about if such a thing would happen, and obviously the baby wouldn't have spoken Lashon Hara, but tzaras can happen in various different ways. In those three places, on a person's house, on a person's clothing, or on a person's skin. And the sages actually describe that that's part of the warning system, that if a person gets it on their house, they should start taking note and say, something's amiss here in my spiritual life. And if they don't take notes, it gets a little bit closer. It ends up on their clothing. And if they don't take a note from that, they'll end up with it on their skin as well.
Miriam had that.
That's correct. That is correct. And we've mentioned before, whenever we come across these parshas, that we should all be blessed to live in an era of tzaras, which is funny as that sounds, but it's an important thing. It's a society has to be on a certain spiritual level to be fit, to be susceptible, that they get such an immediate response from God to their words. That's a blessing, that you're so close, you're on such a spiritual plane, that's how the relationship goes. We are, unfortunately, now for 2,000 years so far removed that it almost doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And so I've used this example before. I'll just throw it in. If you've ever been at a baseball stadium or a football stadium or any large sporting event, the kind that holds 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 seats, and you've stopped by the washroom on your way out after the event. So generally, that's not the cleanest place that you will find after some type of event with such enormous amounts of people. If you were to, after washing your hands with a paper towel, dispose it in the garbage, and you saw that the garbage was totally overflowing, and so you put it on the top, and then you watched it sort of roll off and land on the floor amongst thousands of other paper towels and other aspects of garbage, that probably wouldn't even make a mark in your mind. You wouldn't notice it because the place is so dirty that, okay, I tried to do what I, you know, you want, I wouldn't claim or accuse any of you of purposely throwing a paper towel on the floor, even in such an environment. You did what you were supposed to do, and, you know, there's no place for it even. It's just, you know, and it's just, so what are you going to do? So you're going to leave it there and walk out. That's what you're going to do, because it doesn't bother you. And if the stadium is, that's what they left the room looking like, that's what it's going to be. If you've ever been to one of those fancy schmancy wedding halls and you walk into the bathroom that's cleaner than any room in my house has ever been, you know, and that's not it. Nothing. It's just like they like it's all crystal and glass and it's like a brand new countertop. You can't even believe what they put into the bathroom. And if you were to, after washing your hand and you threw it towards the wastebasket, which is made out of gold, and it hit the edge and fell off. And there was a guy, or in your case, a girl, whatever it may be, that's actually, so I've been in restaurants where they're actually like people, they're standing there giving you a towel, and it's like the strangest thing. You would be inclined to pick it up, because the environment demands, even in a bathroom, I can't leave my used paper towel absolutely on the floor like that. The environment requires an action, a reaction. We react and relate to the environment around us. So the sages describe our words when we live in a world that is sullied, that is filthy, and a person utters a word that's also sullied and filthy, well, in that world, it doesn't elicit a response. It just, we live, that's the world we live in. Another word, another inappropriate usage. Nebuch, but that's just the way it is. But when you live in a pristine, pure, clean environment, and then you were to hear someone say something, it would send shudders. Like, wow, how could you talk like that? And so if we lived in such a world, there would be a spiritual response to the way that we speak, because it would sully the environment in a way that it would demand that kind of response. So halavai, it's a blessing. We should live in an era where we see the words that come out of our mouths in such an environment, and we live in such an environment, and it makes a difference. It ruined the room. That if such a paper towel on the floor would ruin the room. You have to have a response. In the stadium, it doesn't ruin the room. The room doesn't demand anything. And so that's sort of how it goes. So we begin this week the parsha of Tzaras, and we begin it in that. So there's one aspect I want to focus on this afternoon. The Torah goes through a great length, the beginning on the bottom of page 608, chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel. Just looking at the left-hand side of the page, if you just want to look at the headlines as we go along, the Torah talks about the basic Tzaras, what's called a Baheres, what's called a Se'es. In verse 18, on page 613, there's something called inflammations. Verse 24, there's something called burns. And the Torah goes through, which we're not going through, all the different categories or qualifications of what different types of tzaras are there. This is all referring to the type on the body. Tzaras on the head or on the face. And then we're going to get to verse 40, Perek Pasuk Mem. Let's get a couple of psukim together, Pasuk Mem. Ready to go? Page 616. So we're flipping through all the others. That was just a couple of highlights on the different topics that are discussed, the different type of discolorations, the different kinds, and the process that goes through. And let's pick up with Pasuk Mem, verse 40. What about Ish ki yimoret rosho? If the hair of a man's head falls out. Nebuch. Oh. As my children say to me, we're getting there, Dad. We're getting there. I know. So, okay, that happens. His head lies bald.
Very fashionable.
says the Torah, Kereyachu. So, no, he's bald at the back of his head. Toharu. But that has nothing to do with Tzaras. Just because the hair itself falls out, that's not a sign of Tzaras. That's just a sign of a man who's going through life and his hair falls out. Kacha. That's how it goes. Toharu. No problem, says the Torah. V'im mipa'at panav yimoreit. But if his hair falls out towards the front of his head, Gibeach, we have a different term. The first pasuk described where his hair fell out, the back half. And we say, Tahar, he's pure, not a problem. Doesn't mean anything. No sign, just because it fell out. What if it fell out from the front half of his hair? Different word, that's called a Gibeach. We have a Kereach in the back and a Gibeach in the front. Says the Chumash in Pasuk Mem Aleph, what's the halacha? Also Tahar, no problem. Baldness, no discrimination. Fine, it falls down the back, falls down the front, no problem. However, says the Chumash, v'chiyeh b'karachat o b'gabachat, but what if in this back half of the baldness, or the front half of the baldness, negel avon adam dam, within the section of the hair that fell out, then we have this white affliction with the red streak running through it, which is the type of affliction of all the psukim that we just skipped over, which can happen anywhere on the body.
Like psoriasis.
I don't know exactly what let's,
yeah.
Whatever, I want to just, as opposed to using whatever medical term, because this is a spiritual malady, if within the baldness itself doesn't bother us, but if within that spot that now has become exposed, there's this whitish discoloration and a reddish streak running through it, which is the primary telltale sign of tzaraas, then the Torah says, tzaraas poirachasi, that then would be an eruption of tzaraas. It's been poreach. Tzaraas erupted here, bikarachto, either on the back half of his baldness, obigabachto, or in the front half of his baldness. Viro, so a kohen, and now the kohen will look, as is always the process when a person suspects they may or may not have tzaraas, man or woman, they call over the kohen, they say, look, look, what's here. And he says, oh, I have this whitish color with a reddish streak, the karachto, in the back half of my baldness. Oh, bekabachto in the front half. Kimare tzaras or basar looks just like a regular tzaras anywhere on the skin. The Cohen will take a look. Says the Torah, ish tzaruahu. Yes, indeed. He's an ish tzarua. He's a man with tzaras. Tamehu, he's tamei. Tamei tamenu ha-kohen. The kohen will now have to declare him contaminated because birosho'o nig'o, his affliction is indeed on his head. And that's the end of the paragraph regarding baldness on the front and the back of his head. Okay, we have a couple of questions we have to address. That's the discussion. Okay, what's the first question that jumps out at you? Excellent. What a funny thing. There seems to be no difference in the halacha. The halacha is the same. If the front half or the back half of the head becomes bald, the baldness alone doesn't mean anything. But if within the skin that's become exposed, there is the appearance of tzaraas, the whitish discoloration with a red streak running through it, whether it be in the front half or the back half, it's tzaraas. Okay. So why are you dividing up the front half and the back half? What difference does it make? Just tell me the halach is. If I have a bald spot on my head, great, no problem. But if it develops tzaraas, then you're a person with tzaraas. That would certainly be something we'd have to address. The second thing, which is a little bit more difficult to pick up on, because we didn't learn all the other psukim, but the last pasuk that we discussed in pasuk Mem Dalet 44 is an odd usage. The opening phrase of that pasuk, of he is a person with tzaraas. Every other time until this pasuk, for the last 30 psukim, when the Torah described the person getting tzaraas, it always says tzaraasi. It is tzaraas. This is the only time that it says to the person, you are a person with tzaraas. Ish tzarua. This is who he is, a person. That's the only time we use a pronoun on the person. Otherwise, we just say, oh, that discoloration, it is. This discoloration is not. It is, it's not. It is, it's not. And here we say, he is a person with tzaraas. Why in this particular instance do we have these differences? The front, the back, and the focus on this person being a tzarua. Now, I want to share with you two comments. First is a comment from the Or HaChaim. We've mentioned him before, one of the classic commentators on the Chumash. So he has two comments to make. Number one, he points out, which is a halacha that's often discussed and mentioned in the halachas of tzaraas, the way the Torah describes in that final pasuk of Mem Dalet 44, it says, he is a person with tzaraas, he is contaminated, the Kohen shall declare him contaminated. It's a strange usage. First the verse says, he is contaminated, and then it says, the Kohen shall declare him contaminated. Was he already contaminated? Why does it say both? And so he points out, as is mentioned many, many times in relation to this, that the person, even if he's intrinsically contaminated, does not take on the status of contamination until the Kohen declares him contaminated. And it must be through the words of the Kohen to say, Tameh. He has to declare and say, you're Tameh. So that even if the person who gets the tzaraas is an expert and he knows this is tzaraas, doesn't make a difference. not until the Kohen declares himself. And the Or Chaim learns from this phrase that if the Kohen does the opposite and makes a mistake, it doesn't work. Let's say he's actually not. The Kohen's making a mistake and he declares a person to be Tomei who's not. So then his words don't have any validity. It must be both, where he is intrinsically contaminated with the declaration, then it takes effect. And many of the commentators point out on that the idea of the sin that we've mentioned, that a person, why is the primary sin that a person gets Lashon Hara, is of course his or her dibur, her speech. And a person always justifies in their minds and says, they're only words. It's no big deal. It's not like I'm hurting anyone. And the answer is, of course, we know it's not true. It's not true. That's a justification we make in our mind until we're on the opposite end of the one receiving the negative words. And then we realize how hurtful and how painful it is. And we all know that a physical wound we get eventually heals up and we move on. But the wounds from words can last a lifetime. Remember things for decades. We'll remember someone said something and it might have been a passing comment by that person, but it digs deep and it doesn't go away. And so the Torah says, you know what your punishment's going to be? It's not going to start until a Kohen says a few words. You may have it, but nothing starts until he declares. And he says, now your tummy, now it starts. You think your words don't matter? You'll see. To you, it's going to start and stop with the words of the Kohen.
So it's there, and the Kohen activates it.
Correct. Basically. That's exactly right. That's why the reason why I mentioned that a comment, the Rav Hirsch speaks that, we're not going to talk about this now, I just want to briefly mention, when he goes there, he has a whole lengthy piece making sure that we correctly understand it as a spiritual punishment and not as a contagious disease. Rav Hirsch points out at great length that there are certain times when the Kohen won't make the declaration. He says, for example, during Yontif, if a person gets tzaras and goes to the Kohen says, not on Yontif, I don't work on Yontif, I'll look at it after Yontif. Or if a chassan during his Sheva Brachos develops it, and he goes to the Kohen says, it's your Sheva Brachos, I don't look at a Sheva Brachos. So it first points out, if it was a contagious disease, those would be the times that we would most want to make sure that he was checked out and pulled out of society, make sure not to make it. But those are the times that he's in the middle of Yontif, he's in the middle of a Sheva Brachos. We'll leave him alone, we're going to deal with this later. And he specifically uses those as his proofs that this is spiritual, and that's why we always try not to use some type of physical malady that we're familiar with, because it's different, even though it might manifest itself in some similar ways, but it was very different. One other comment from the Or Chaim. So he points out in the language where we say, he has tzaras, the first time that we describe it in such a personal way, he says, why do we do that? So Or Chaim says, because where else does tzaras, it's beyond the skin. Anywhere else, person has ability to cover it up and hide it. You know, I know that I have tzaras and it bothers me. Am I going to go to the Kohen? I'm not going to go. If your hair falls out in the front half or the back half, whichever falls out, and then in that missing spot, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to try to. No, of course you're thinking, okay, you wear a hat, do this, you know. All of a sudden a person starts wearing a hat they never did before. You know, something's going on. Something's going on. So the Or Chaim points out, we know that sin, that the tzaras comes as a result of sin. And usually, he says the Or Chaim's language is, Hashem yachosh al kvod habrios. Generally, Hashem has great concern for what we call kvod habrios, the dignity of mankind. There's a concept which finds itself in halacha in numerous places. The Gemara talks about where when the sages established certain laws, there are many, many rabbinic laws, as you know, if the rabbinic law ran up against kvod habrios, the dignity of man, so the dignity of mankind pushes aside the rabbinic enactment. This is not on a Torah law, this is on rabbinic law. Because of the significance of kvod habrios. And a classic example, it's funny that I should use two bathroom examples in the same class, I'll apologize. But the Gemara says, there's a prohibition of carrying, you know, you can't carry without an Erev. Now, you can't carry outside in a biblical area, but let's say you live in a rabbinic area like we do. So since it's not really a public place, it's not big enough, but rabbinically you can't carry outside without, shall we? So rabbinically we can make an Erev. Since it's only rabbinic prohibition, let's say a person in those days, the restrooms were generally either outside or in a field, whatever it may be, and a person might need a number of small stones in order to clean oneself after using the bathroom. They run into a problem. How do I can't carry them. The Gemara says, there's no prohibition. Kavod habrios, in order for the dignity of mankind, will push aside a rabbinic prohibition. A man, woman, needs to be in an honorable state, and that is such significance that we push aside certain rabbinic law in order to maintain human dignity. It's very much. Torah law is a different discussion, but if it was rabbinic law in the first place, that's it. So says the Or HaChaim, generally there's a kind of covet of brios. If such a person would be struck with tzaras, where their hair fell out, and tzaras is, it's as if it's announcing, I have a problem. Sure. So Or HaChaim says, how could it be such a thing? It goes against all of the principles that we have. Must be such a horrific, such a state that such a person would have gone to, that we went from the house to the clothing to the body, but not just anywhere on the body. You took out a billboard and said, look at me. So that the Torah says, you have tzara, there's no hiding. You, this person, has tzaras, must be something to, he uses the word Rachmanu Latzlan, Hashem should save us from such a punishment, to be aware of what happened. What did this person do that would elicit such a response? And it's a way like of everyone, like understand, like whatever was something, it's a sign. I want to take that and take it to one other step. Jumping ahead a few hundred years in Jewish history to the Netziv, Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva in Valazhin, who we've spoken about many times in our Great Jewish Books course, which was the elite prime yeshiva, first yeshiva really of its kind, which was established in the early 1800s and closed in 1891. Remind me to tell you an interesting thing when I didn't think of this, but just... it'll tie into what we're about to say. So the Netziv was one of the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Valazhin, and he gave a Chumashir on Friday mornings. And from that Chumashir, the students took notes and eventually published a commentary on the Chumash from him. So he addresses these questions. He's troubled by also the idea of focusing on this person and saying, what did he do so bad? And the division between the front half of the head and the back half of the head, it's a strange division. So he writes as follows. He picks up on the thread, which as soon as I say it, you'll all would have said it yourself. Let's phrase it as a question. If a person were to get such a tremendous type of tzaras, and they get it on their head, which is in this public place where everybody can see where it is, what would you guess was involved in the source of their misdeeds?
They insulted someone publicly, Lashon Hara.
So now, let me take it out of Lashon Hara for a moment. What else would there be outside of Lashon Hara? What would be symbolized by the fact that it happened on his head, he became bald?
They embarrassed somebody.
He wrote something?
So you're...
That's not, I said,
they're all good things. All good things. He takes the approach that it has to do with the mind, the brain. It's the Torah says the hair fell off in the front or in the back, and tzaras happens on that spot. It must be some inappropriate thought process. And he divides it up into two. There are two types of... Now, let's do a little historical context.
Which have to be speech. It can be only...
A little historical context. Yeah, listen to this, what he says. And it's always important. We've said this many times when we learned Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch was in Germany in the late 1800s, and he was dealing with the Reform movement. And we saw many times how his comments are very clearly targeting the Orthodox world struggling with the new hip... Reform movement. We saw that many times. The Netziv was dealing with something else. He was dealing with what we call maskilim. He was dealing with enlightened Jews. Not in Germany, in Western Europe, but in Eastern Europe. And he was dealing with the maskilim who were part of this enlightened movement. They were Jews, but they were involved, they didn't view the eternity of Torah and mitzvahs as primary, but in secular studies and secular knowledge, and it was a move away from all religion, and all the movements, the Jews were in the forefront of
socialism.
Of all the socialism and communism, and the maskilim movement was swallowed up by the early Zionists as they moved out of Eastern Europe and they moved to Israel, but that socialist, communist movement, anti-religious, all was part of that which was the biggest threat to the yeshiva. And what was fascinating historically about the Valazhin yeshiva, despite the fact that it was the elite yeshiva in its height, it did not have more than 400 students, as Rebbe Wein used to point out many times, but it was with all the geniuses of the geniuses. The way that you got into Volozhin, as Rebbe Wein points out, is there was like a quota system based on how a town, how much money the towns in Europe supported the yeshiva, entitled you to a certain amount of slots. So the big city of Warsaw, which maybe gave X amount of dollars a year, so they were entitled to 6 students a year. And a small little town, some little shtut that gave X amount of dollars, they were allotted 1 student. So from your town, you could send 1, 2, 3, 5 students. Well, who goes? So it was either the wealthy or it was the brilliant ones. They were the ones who would come back and then they'd go back to their hometown and serve, whatever it may be. But it was the elite of the elite that would gather from all of Europe into the city of Volozhin. But it was the only place to go with a great mind, because most of the universities will not allow a Jew into the universities. So all the elite Jewish minds, that was the place to go. Within the yeshiva of Volozhin, this elite yeshiva, were major pockets of maskilim, who under their gemaras were writing and reading all sorts of poetry and secularism and all their other stuff. And that was the threat to, if Hirsch was afraid that a child would, the youngsters would become reform, and what the Netziv was worried about were that the youth were going to become maskilim. With that very brief historical background, listen to what the Netziv has to say about this particular parsha, in which the Torah is by the front half of the head and the back half of the head. See, he writes, Our psukim are osu, it's a sign, al chet deos mishubashos, on corrupt mindsets, corrupt thought processes. And there are two different types, he writes. One type is mishubash b'chakira philosophit, where a person has corrupt philosophical approaches. Meaning they've sat down, and they've thought it through, and they've worked out a philosophy in which they say, Torah mitzvot is archaic, we don't need it, and we have a new philosophy. And the new philosophy is whatever we want to call it. Socialism, secularism, you name it, we have it. That's one type of Dea Mishubash, a corrupt thought processes. And the second, She'enu Chayker, Ve'enu Mamin. He doesn't think, he doesn't look into it, he just doesn't believe. Two different types. You have the person who just says, you know, I just don't buy it. I don't buy it. And you could say, you want to have a philosophical discussion about it? He says, no, I'm not interested. I just think it's a bunch, the whole thing is a farce. I don't believe it. And then you have your philosopher, and he's going to come with books and with arguments and all of them. So those are two different approaches, and you need to deal with both, but they both exist, as the Jewish people are. We are a phenomenal people, and we are a fascinating people, and we've dealt with everything. But those are two completely separate types of approaches. Now again, this is the world he's living in. See, he sees in these psukim. Now he makes a very interesting thing, which I think in modern day science we would have to adapt it a little bit. He says the front half of the head, the front half of the brain, is where the intelligent thought, the cerebrum, comes from. That represents the philosophical approach of philosophically denying and arguing with and going against everything. The back half represents the person who's not thinking, who just says, I don't believe, I'm not interested. Now, he doesn't say this, I don't know how much science they had in the 1880s in White Russia. But I would say what we do know, now the back of the head, at the base of the back, is the cerebellum, which is the source of our balance and our ability to regulate. So one can make esoteric connection in terms of the person who simply says, you know, without thinking, I don't believe, that would be connected to the part of our brain that, without thinking, gives us our balance and equilibrium. And so that would represent that. He doesn't make that comment. I'm just sort of adding that to this. But he says, that's why it's... He said, why should this be divided in half? It doesn't make any sense. It's the same law. Must be that the Torah is hinting at two different types of corrupt thought processes. One, which is a thinking, philosophical argument against Torah and mitzvot. And one is just, I don't believe. I'm interested. I don't care. I don't want anything to do with this. And those are the two halves. Why they are divided into two. Why does the Torah then focus on this person and say, Tamehu, this person is Tameh? See, he says that extra phrase, and that the Kohen must declare him Tomei, is lahazir l'chol adam lihizoyer mimenu harbe, to warn every person, stay far away from such a person. Because the other person who gets tzaras, a person who speaks lashon hara, or who's involved in all sorts of other bodily pleasures and taiva and desires which might bring to him tzaras, okay, that's not contagious. So this person has a certain drive, a taiva, to eat this or to do this, whatever it may be, and then he ends up with tzaras. Okay, that's not as contagious if I know about him, I speak to him, he has his desires, I have my own desire, whatever they may be. But if you speak to somebody who has a philosophical approach to life, and he's a denier, and he doesn't believe, that is super contagious. That is, and he was living that threat, where they were actively recruiting the youth of the Jewish people and the minds of the Jewish people and saying, the Enlightened movement, which had swept through all of Europe at this point, this is the future. And so the verse, Pasuk Mem Dalet, Ish Tsaruahu, look, it's on his head, it's bald, it's for everyone to see, and then the Torah declares, this is a person with tzaras, Tamehu, he's Tameh, Tameh Yitamenu our Kohen, let the Kohen declare him Tameh. He goes so far as to say, this is an amazing thing, it just shows you an insight into the times, whenever you read a commentary, you have to put yourself into that commentary. He says, not just to warn every person, but he says, but the Kohen might think, I'm the Kohen. I'm spiritually strong. I should go and talk to him. I'll convince him otherwise. To that, the Netziv says, Tameh Yitamenu HaKohen. The Kohen has to go over and say, you're Tameh, I can't go near you. Because this mindset is such that once a person has Shehigia Le'apikursus, once you arrive at that, Shuvein Roy L'Toich, he doesn't listen to rebuke. Because how are you going to rebuke him? You rebuke, he's going to say, wherever the source of your rebuke is coming from, I don't believe in your whole system. So from your system, you're going to tell me I'm doing something wrong? Your system doesn't, I don't believe in. So you can't do anything. Person who has a physical desire or a drive, so you can rebuke such a person, he's within your system. When a person takes themselves out of the system, how do you talk to them? Now, again, we, in today's day and age, it's a different discussion. We have in my life, so rarely, not I would say never, but I've come into contact, as I'm sure all of you have, with, I don't want to put a number, hundreds, thousands of non-observant Jews. That's the way of the world, right? How many of them would say, philosophically, I don't believe in... Very few. They grew up in a certain way, they were taught in a certain way, this is what they believe. This doesn't talk to our day and age almost at all. A little bit every once in a while you see it, but almost none. But you see in his data, the non-religious Jew that he was dealing with wasn't because this is the way that I was raised. It was because this is what I believe. And I think you should believe this way too, because this is the new age. This is the new way of doing things. And it's fascinating to see how he took this series of verses, which I'm sure was read through, baldness in the front, baldness in the back. It's one of 30 verses on Tzaras. Here, there, everywhere. He says, no. These verses are highlighting something about a corrupt mindset. And it can be a corrupt mindset of active, philosophical, or just, I don't believe. And Tumit, so this, we point to such a person and say, that is a danger. The greatest asset that we have, of course, is our mind, our ability to think, our ability to believe. And this touches on a lot of interesting things. We're required to think things through. We are required not to be robotic people following after. And within that requirement to think and to understand and to question, if you've ever been to as you are right now, to a class, we question. Why did the verse say this? Why didn't it say that? What does this mean? We live off of questions. And so living off of questions within a paradigm of, this is a system, this is a godly, divine system that's the most geschmack, beautiful thing ever. Within that system, question, question, question. Because within that system, every question just leads to greater understanding. The danger, which he's railing against, is stepping outside of that system. Very hard to put yourself back in. And when you come across it, to be lizoyer, one has to be careful because it is indeed contagious. And he sees that within the front half and back half, the two different types of corrupt mindsets of this verse of Tzaras. I had a question that I didn't get to. Yeah.
Yeah, so if I understand all of this, but isn't it also to prepare him as Tameh to tell